Hey everybody, I'm Eureka John, and I'm here with Spencer, aka Clinaminic, and we're both with JournoDAO.xyz, and this is our podcast called Press Fix, and this is the official JournoDAO podcast, and JournoDAO is an incubator for projects that transform and rethink the journalism ecosystem. Using Web3 tools, we are building the future of journalism. Let me turn this music off. All right. Okay, so what's up, Spencer?
I'm doing well. Glad to be on the podcast again and get this going and talk about some nerdy journalist technology.
Yeah. We've done two episodes so far as a DAO, and that was quite a while ago. And now we're kind of getting the plate off of the back burner. And yeah, we've all been busy. There's six of us founders in the DAO, and we all have careers and we have lives and stuff. In Web3, we love Web3 and the decentralization and the tools that are being used to help transform journalism, but we all have to survive as well. So some time is freed up for me, and seems like some time is freed up for Spencer as well, so we can pick up the torch and carry this on again. And we hope to be doing many more. So, and with other guests and other members of the DAO jumping in as well. So do you want to take a second and explain what the mission of JournoDAO is to you here?
Sure. Yeah. So I personally don't have a background in journalism, but I got acquainted with John and some of the other founding members of JournoDAO, like Eric Mack and Crystal Street and Keith Axline. And the common thread is we're all passionate about how this technology can make the media landscape healthier and can perhaps improve certain aspects or practices within journalism and how we discover content and verify content and combat misinformation. But the technology itself is still pretty nascent and still pretty inaccessible to most people. And its exact applications in journalism are still largely undetermined. And JournoDAO is at the forefront of determining what exactly those applications will look like.
Yeah. Well said. You know, I find myself, I'm not a journalist by background either. And I'm coming from the Web3 guy, you know, and before this, I even worked at a propane plant and kind of got into Web3 and just went down the rabbit hole and started researching the technology. You know, I've had experience in, you know, web development, and that's really about it. But I was just super intrigued by the personal sovereignty and the financial sovereignty that crypto and Web3 can bring. And then also the anti-censorship aspect of it. And that's kind of how I got involved with you guys here in the JournoDAO. I'm a content creator. I love creating content. And this has been a great outlet for it. But one thing I noticed is like there's all these deep fakes and everything going on in social media. And AI is able to create imagery of like a car burning and stuff like that to where the smoke even moves when you just alter it a little bit and stuff like that. And it reacts to other objects in the space. And so it's really hard to determine what's real and what's fake now. And even celebrities are like Scarlett Johansson is going on a protest against AI using her likeness and image and deep fakes. And you don't know what's real. And so we have the tools and journalists have the tools to be able to combat this type of fakery and also combat censorship that is being thrust upon people. And, I went 2 years ago to the ONA with the Online News Association conference in LA, and you went this last year to the one in Philadelphia. And my experience there was, it got kind of a lukewarm reception from a lot of journalists of just about, you know, them not being aware of these tools or just thinking crypto and NFT are just for like moon boys and scammers and all that type of stuff, you know, when moon, when Lambo. And they didn't seem to understand. And then when we were up on stage trying to explain the significance of NFTs and how it can verify and validate and create anti-censorship capabilities, we got heckled by, you know, a guy in the audience. And it was an interesting experience. And it's me not having a journalism background and the credentials, I was happy to have Eric and Keith up there on the stage who do have journalism credentials to kind of like be there, you know, all together as a group and help each other out. Eric and Keith did a great job as well. What was your experience like in Philadelphia? Did you get kind of the same reaction, or has things changed by then?
It was the same in that it still remains largely misunderstood or ignored or written off. Thankfully, in our experience, we had a small panel. Keith, Eric, Crystal, and myself had a panel talking about decentralized infrastructure for media and content and social and how it can affect journalism. So we gave this small panel there, very interactive and intimate. There were a dozen people that showed up, so less crowded than a lot of the other big panels there. But the people that showed up were actually receptive to it. And so, like, thankfully, we didn't have any hecklers in our round. I was kind of bracing for that, given the reputation this technology has. But thankfully, our reception was good. The people that came had questions, stuck around after. We had a dialogue with them, people asking questions about, like, what do you mean by decentralized infrastructure? What do you mean by distributed ledger technology? Like, where does cryptocurrency fit into this? And, like, is it needed? And thankfully, I think for a lot of the purposes we're interested in, cryptocurrency and a lot of the speculative and financial instruments that the technology is known for aren't really needed, and they're certainly not central, like center stage, that you know, as many people may expect.
Oh, did I lose you?
Is this, okay. This good?
Yes, okay, there you are.
I saw the little spinning
thing.
But yeah, like, so I think the popular kind of not quite ignorance, but like the popular coverage of a lot of this technology does seem to focus on all the financial instruments. And so combating that and broadening people's understandings, that still remains a bit of a task, but thankfully we didn't have any hecklers.
Yeah. When you have a bull market, you know, you have everybody just like, you know, Lambo, wind moon, and we're going to get rich, and they love the technology for the finance stuff. But we've been through this bear market in the past like year, and it's really separated the wheat from the chaff.
So. I love this, bear market conditions. I so much prefer this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you get really technical. And one thing that you said that resonated with me is a lot of the journalists didn't really understand what decentralization is and distributed ledger. And we kind of, from a Web3 perspective, tend to take that for granted that everybody knows that, you know, and we don't. So you really, you and Keith of the DAO, of the group of us, you guys really tend to tackle some of the more technical aspects of it. And I love it, you know, and I try to dumb it down as much as possible to be able to communicate it with it to, you know, I try to keep up with you guys as much as I can, but it's not always successful. So, you know, I'm really glad that you're wanting to jump in and participate in this, so we can try to recruit other journalists to use these tools. So journalists, go to check out, you know, journodao.xyz and this website. Come join us in the Discord. We have a community meeting every, what'd you say, Wednesday?
Every other Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time.
Yeah, 9 a.m. Pacific time. Okay, 11 o'clock Central, noon Eastern time, United States. And it's on a Zoom call. So you can keep your camera off if you want. You don't have to talk. You can just listen, or you can jump in full edge, full force. And, you know, we would love to hear from you and hear your perspective, any ideas you have, and to contribute into what we're doing. So, yeah, and to just help equip journalists to fight censorship, to get good on-chain reporting and stuff like that, and yeah, to fight all these deep fakes going around and this misinformation. So yeah, anyway, one of the technical topics that you and Keith and a lot of the other people in the DAO have been talking about lately are what's called attestations. And to me, that word doesn't really mean a whole lot, and I've asked you guys here and there in the community calls, like, yeah, can you kind of explain it? Like, I'm five, and mainly, I mean, I admit, like, a lot of times I've kind of zoned out and I've not understood what you guys are talking about. So the purpose of this episode today is I really wanted to like drill down what attestations are. And I guess just from an extremely just like cracking the door open type of perspective, it seems to me it's like a notary public on a type of document. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comparison there. And I think at a very high level, it's a tool for people to add little bits of data or information onto some public database, in this case, a blockchain. And that's like so much of this value proposition is that where that data is being stored is publicly accessible, it's open source, and it's very difficult to censor, just given that it's a peer-to-peer network. And so that's like the whole value prop kind of stems from that. And then attestations are a way that you can structure certain bits of data into field types, and you can attest, you know, attest or make claims to the validity of certain bits of information, or you can make a claim just as a reference point for some future reference. Everything is timestamped. Okay. So it's just contributing data to this and assigning like some kind of ownership or authorship of that data or that content that you attest to.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I can attest to that. I can vouch for that. I'll say all in favor, say yay or nay. Right. Or, can I get a witness? You know, right. Yeah. Okay. But let's go like rewind way back. You said it's like a public database.
Yeah.
What does a database consist of? Because I think, and I've taken some information technology classes. I know what a relational database is. It's a database consists of subject fields, I guess, and spreadsheets, and a spreadsheet containing that data. So you have the menu, the vertical and the horizontal menu, and then you have the spreadsheet full of numbers. And in a relational database, some of those spreadsheets will share some of the items on the columns and on the rows. And so you can cross-reference and use like SQL language to go back and forth between them, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding of it as well. I'm not as familiar with relational databases, but that's at least how I understand databases in general. And I'm not a data scientist.
Okay. So when you're saying like a public database, so databases are generally in like a CRM system in a company, in a corporation, they have a database of address of customers, a database of part numbers, you know, a database of orders, past, present, maybe future orders to be fulfilled. And so maybe they might all share a certain part number and all that type of stuff. How could one be public?
I think at least in the context that I'm aware of for these public databases, the ones that we're talking about are all peer-to-peer in nature rather than being privately maintained. It's a network of computers that are all kind of collectively maintaining this database and making it public by uploading it and all, you know, contributing to the amount of storage that the network has and making sure that everything is verified. It's these kind of peer-to-peer data structures that are generally more difficult to censor. I mean, there's trade-offs, you know, not all information is information you want to be public, but if you do want some public information, these peer-to-peer databases tend to be strong because they don't rely on a given business to just perpetually survive market cycles and stay solvent and stay in business. And you don't have to trust a given institution or company to not censor certain content. And, you know, even if you do trust a given company to not censor certain content, if they are in control of private servers, they may be subject to regulations that would require them to delete certain content in certain national jurisdictions. And all of that kind of censorship is sometimes virtually impossible with peer-to-peer networks. And so that's kind of the value add for free speech or censorship resistance, and also just longevity in general, even if what you're posting isn't politically sensitive or controversial, but you just want to be confident that it'll be around for your whole life, probably, then some of these peer-to-peer options are arguably more appealing.
Okay. So it's basically everybody either volunteers or they get paid. And that's where the token comes into play. To run these databases on their computers, whether it be here in Austin, Texas, in California, New York, China, So say, we've recorded this before, but we didn't hit record. We've talked, so we got to talk through some of this. But I use an example of, like, you know, say the government of Kentucky has a database full of moonshiners. And they don't want that database to become out there. But that database of moonshiners is on a distributed ledger, a distributed database that is run by a bunch of different people having their own copies of that on the node. And each time somebody adds a new address to that database of moonshiners, it gets added to, and that information gets passed around to every single person running that computer on that database. And whether that be in Kentucky or in China or whatever. So if the government of Kentucky says we want to shut that down and they shut down the Kentucky computer, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Right. So that's where the redundancy comes into play and works for it and is anti-censorship.
Exactly. And especially if the network itself spans more than one national jurisdiction, because then it would require jurisdictions to cooperate in terms of enforcing certain censorship policies. And it just, it becomes more and more expensive and unlikely. Is this better?
Okay, there you are. So it becomes more and more.
You're exactly right. As long as the network gets bigger, it can span more jurisdictions, it gets tougher to censor, essentially.
Yeah, okay. So it becomes too costly to censorship, to censor it. And to, yeah, you can't take over all the power on the network, because it becomes too costly for anybody to do so, or any company. So yeah, the cost outweighs the desire to censor. Interesting. Okay. So you have these attestations. So we were talking about information being uploaded to the database and that being kind of a permanent record. How is it that people can't censor on a blockchain, a distributed database?
At least
At
least in the context of something like a Ethereum attestation service, without getting too much into the weeds, the way that it's structured is like open source code that runs on one of these peer-to-peer networks. So it's not like a service or a platform that is maintained by a company. Like the company has a web app that you can use to interact with it, but even if they went out of business, the actual tools would still exist and you could still use them, just in a less user-friendly way. Okay. So that's the difference here, and that the means by which you can upload content and data to this shared peer-to-peer database will exist even after the company that created it goes out of business. And I think, you know, given just the nature of market cycles, you know, most businesses fail. That's so profound about a lot of these tools, is that the tools that they build can actually outlive the tool builders.
Okay. So somebody's saying if they upload like a photo or some kind of article or a video, they say, well, it's verifiable truth on the blockchain, but can't anybody upload something to the blockchain? And as you know, just because it has a hash on it doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah, that's the kind of the nuance about verification of authorship, is you can get a timestamp of when something is approved, but and all you see is that this content was uploaded by this account address, which is sort of, you can sort of think of it like an email address or a phone number, a given kind of account ID that a person has that they like through which they interact with this database. So if I were to upload a photo to Ethereum, like if I were to upload a link to a photo through Ethereum attestation service, people would be able to see that this link was uploaded by this wallet address, which would be my wallet address. But then it's not necessarily evident to people that my wallet address is actually associated with me as a person. And so there's that little like distinction between me as a person, you know, with a legal identity, a natural person, and then the account that I use to upload this stuff, because I can make multiple accounts. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to make these accounts. So it's a different sort of verification that's possible. You can get timestamps. You can see when a piece of content was first published by someone, but that doesn't necessarily indicate that it wasn't published somewhere else on some other database before that, some private database. So it's just a different sort of verification that it enables. It's not like bulletproof. There are still some kind of ambiguities.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I guess the point of an attestation then is not necessarily to have the content up there, but to have multiple entities verify that something indeed happened.
Yeah. And the notion of verifying and like verifying the authenticity of a piece of content, or verifying that it was the actual author that uploaded it and I'm not just plagiarizing someone. Yeah. All of that can be established through people vouching for each other's attestations. And I think that's where this kind of system of credibility and reputation and truth emerges, mm-hmm. because these attestations can be used to reference one another. Like if I upload some bit of data through this attestation service, someone else, some institution with some kind of credibility or reputation for being a source of truth can then vouch for it and like make public that they vouch for it. And that can be seen as a sort of a gesture of trustworthiness for the original attestation that I made. Because if I make some attestation, if I share some data to this peer-to-peer database and no one vouches for it or anything, then you're just taking the word of an anonymous user who uploaded this piece of
content. Yeah, saying this is true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so you have an example of an attestation that you've created. I wanted to go over this, then we'll circle back to what you're talking about multiple people attesting to it. But I think it's helpful to kind of to see, and then for those of you listening, to hear how this creating an attestation schema works. And then, yeah, we can go back to multiple people verifying it. So if you want to kind of explain this and to the audio listeners as well, what you have on screen here.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm showing an example of a particular attestation on, using Ethereum attestation service. But for the purposes of explaining this, I'm going to not just use the terminology they have here. They use the term attestation and schema, but I think it may be a bit more intuitive for people new to this to refer to this as like a template for how data can be structured. And so in this particular template, someone made this template. Anyone can make these templates for how users can upload certain kinds of data. It's just a way of structuring how people upload what kind of data. It's almost like a form, in that there are fields to a form that you can fill out, like name, address, email address, website link, and then people can fill out those forms and then publish that form. It's very much like that. And you can create templates with different field types, and then publish that template for people to use to fill out that template and publish that template. So you can then have like a whole stack of instances of this template that have been filled out.
Okay, so you're basically here with this template have created, and what that's also called a schema.
Yeah.
An empty spreadsheet. Like with these fields, exactly. You're creating the rows and the columns of the spreadsheet for people, anybody to fill in, right?
That's a great way to put it. Yes. Yeah, so like in this case, the particular template someone made is some kind of a record of a donation that took place. So the four fields in this template or schema is the term that this tool uses are donor, donee, the amount that was donated, and the type of asset that was donated. And so that's represented by these four field types, and these four field types comprise this template. So if someone wants to make a record or some kind of recording or note of a donation that took place, they would use this template. They would specify the donor, the donee, the amount that was donated, and the ID or the type of the asset that was donated. And then they would publish that. And to your spreadsheet analogy, it would be like populating a row of that spreadsheet. If there was a column for donor, a column for donee,
okay,
a column for amount, a column for token ID, then someone were to use that template and publish it, it would be like filling out a row with those four fields.
I see. Okay. And then you could have a signer on that does the attestation basically, right? So you would have like a donor. So say I were to donate to the American Heart Association and I would be the donor, and the donee would be in the address field of the American Heart Association. Then there'd be the amount, like let's say one ETH, to them. And I could attest to that. American Heart Association could attest to that. And then you could have like a third party lawyer witness, you know, or as many witnesses as you want, right, to sign that attestation. And then they would be participating in that. And that's what kind of seals the deal and adds validity and weight to it.
Exactly. Yeah. And your point about it, it also recording the account address of whoever published that attestation. That's another really important aspect about this, because then you're able to see, oh, this account made this attestation. Oh, and they also, you can click on that account and see all the other attestations they made. And you can kind of get a sense of what social network they're in, what kind of activity they're doing, you know, what kind of information they're uploading to this database. But yeah, the whole point of establishing legitimacy of this stuff, because because this is all permissionless and free, anyone can use this. It's not necessarily legitimate. The legitimacy comes from other parties vouching for what you're attesting to.
Okay, and so each participant in this attestation brings their own. And I've heard you call this a knowledge graph before. And so say the lawyer that was the witness graduated from Brooklyn Law in 2020, right? And so say Brooklyn Law were to issue their JD certificates, their degrees on the blockchain. And so they could create an attestation, Brooklyn Law as the issuer, Jim Smith, the witness, as the issuee. And then the hash transaction that would be attached to the JD diploma, and then the issuer and the issuee could both make attestations to that, as well as maybe like the dean as a witness over there. And so Jim Smith, the witness, when he came over to vouch for this donor attestation between you and the American Heart Association, he also brings his social graph over from his previous experience from graduating from Brooklyn Law, and all that can kind of just like compound each other, right? And adding a lot more weight and authority to a specific attestation, right?
Exactly. It's exactly that sort of network effect that brings a sense of legitimacy and verifiability and like a frame of reference and context to all this stuff. And that would increase with adoption, because in the absence of all of that context, it is a bit more of a Wild West making attestations. And, you know, if you're trying to verify it, you may not have a full sense of context if there's only a handful of people using this. But as thousands, tens of thousands of people start doing this, there is a bit of a shared knowledge graph that emerges. Uh-huh. And to get back to the fundamental value prop of the underlying technology, that knowledge graph exists essentially on digital public infrastructure with this peer-to-peer database. I think that could be a useful way to think about this for some people. Okay. Technology is digital public infrastructure. That's very difficult for any one institution to seize control of or to exert any kind of any kind of value system on. It's very unopinionated underlying infrastructure. And so that's like all of these attestations people are making contribute to this shared knowledge graph and sense of context. And that's like, the more people start using it, the more context is added, the more it's actually becomes useful, because then you'd be able to see, oh, this is so-and-so, and they uploaded this article at this time point here, and I can trust that because this whole network is structured in a way to maintain that and to make it difficult to falsify, if not impossible, to falsify this stuff.
Okay, so the authority is not necessarily, you know, Jim Smith or American Heart Association or you and me or Brooklyn Law or anything like that. The authority is actually the Ethereum blockchain that is holding. Okay.
In this case, because this one is based on Ethereum, and this kind of logic, to an extent, can apply to other blockchains or other distributed databases. But like, the unique thing about blockchains is like the presence that users can have, and like the agency users can have through their account addresses and everything, and you'd be able to tell what actions people have taken, just given the nature of this technology and its transparency.
Yeah, so that's what separates it from just being something on the blockchain or an NFT or anything like that, because that's what I think where a lot of people would be confused. Wasn't that just like an NFT on the blockchain? Anybody can make it. Well, the weight of the knowledge and the social graph are what really create that validity versus just anybody being able to put something up there. So, yeah.
Exactly. And there's also like the sense of context that would come from like if the New York Times wanted to make an attestation, they would have a wallet address and they can deploy an attestation. If it's just that wallet address, no one could really be sure, is this really the New York Times? If the New York Times were to tweet or make some other kind of public statement somewhere and link to this attestation, that would endow that attestation with a kind of legitimacy that you wouldn't otherwise get without that kind of external context.
Yeah.
So a lot of the legitimacy comes from external context.
Okay. So it adds the weight and the authority without adding the censorship capability to that authority.
Exactly. Yeah. Because New Times would be able to vouch for stuff and kind of share its credibility to other attestations that are made by other journalists, but it wouldn't be able to gatekeep who can use this tool.
Okay.
Like the only authority the New York Times would have in that situation is it can choose not to vouch for some attestation, or it can choose to reject or say that this is illegitimate or something like that. And that's that's only worth as much as that institution's word is worth.
Absolutely.
Stop that person being rejected from actually using the tool and essentially sharing their opinion or speaking their mind.
Yeah, an authoritative digital signature. Yeah. So you had something else on the screen here.
So this
the form to create a new attestation. So let's take a quick look at this one.
So this is using the same template with donor, donee amount. This is just all the information about the template itself and all of these IDs and unique identifiers. This is what makes it easy to verify that this is all unique. Each template has a unique identifier. And then if you wanted to actually publish through this template, publish some bits of data, make an attestation through this schema, then you would click on it. And this is what it looks like to actually make an attestation for this. So I would put in the wallet address, the donor, if that's me, then I would put in my address, the donee, the amount being donated, and just the ID of the token itself, because these are all algorithms that have unique identifiers. I would put in just something to identify what the type of the asset that's being donated.
Okay.
And then I could publish it here. And if I do this, it would be actually publishing it to the blockchain, in this case, Ethereum, and everyone would be able to see this. And I could make it so that it's revocable so that I can take it back and sort of unpublish it if I want. Or I can make it non-revocable, in which case when I publish it, it's there permanently so long as the Ethereum network keeps working. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask, back in the 60s, doctors said that smoking was good for you. And what if the American Heart Association had signed that back then? Could they reel that back?
Exactly. And I mean, that's one of the things we've been thinking about in JournoDex. This has been a big part of how we're thinking about using this in journalism, is if we're trying to facilitate people publishing documents to any arbitrary storage location, whether it's Arweave, another example of a peer-to-peer storage layer that's better suited for full-on documents. This is more just suited for little bits, like fields of information, almost like metadata. You wouldn't really use this to post a PDF or something. You can post a link to a PDF on this, and then that link would be published publicly, and anyone would be able to go to that link. That's the idea. Is like, do we want people to be able to revoke this? We want to leave it totally up to them. How can this system be structured in a way that won't break if people are revoking attestations? We've got a couple ideas for how to do this, but it might be might be in the scope of this conversation.
Well, you got to start somewhere, and this is like a really great start, and you can work out the kinks of using digital IDs, how to revoke stuff and do revisions. Do you create like a revision trail and not necessarily have to show what the revision was, but just the hash that shows that it was indeed altered or revised? There's a lot of different ways you could approach it, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, that's exactly. And that's one of the things that excites me the most about this is the implications for version history of documents and edits. And one like one way is like we could make it so that these attestations aren't revocable, but they can be overridden if you publish a new version of it that can like become the new official version, and then the previous version is like saved in like an archive essentially, but it's all there and it can be all public if you wanted all of these edit, if you wanted all these versions of edits of an article you wrote, if you want every version of it to be public and publicly auditable and verifiable, you, this technology could facilitate that.
Yeah. So before the screen, before you showed the schema of how to set up the actual internet fill-in field, you know, the form, you know, the, or the spreadsheet. And then on this screen that you just switched over from, this is the actual attestation that you could sign. And then you could send it to somebody else to sign as well. Say, hey, can you sign this as well? Just to, you know, verify this, in this case, this donor, you know,
Yeah. This is what it looks like filling out the donation template. And then this is some information about the donation template. If I wanted to make a new template, I can show you that.
So it's like another copy that you could make for somebody to sign. Like, you know, I would, I'm giving my, you know, old socks to Goodwill.
Exactly.
Yeah, so and then I signed that I did that. And then they also signed it, and you can send them the link to the other copy, right?
Yeah. And so like we can do that. If you wanted to donate socks
to
some institution, you'd have, and this is what making a new template would look like. So if we wanted to make a template for sock donations, we can fill it out like this. So I just added a field for sock donor name.
Yeah.
And so that would be, you would put in your name, and then Goni institution.
Yeah.
And another string there for that name, you know, sock brand. You know, like you can create however many of these as you want and have different data types here, which kind of gets under the hood a bit too much. But the idea is that all of this stuff is very composable and modular, and it's open source, and it can't be shut down.
Yeah, and you can create an infinite amount of schemas by just creating new field types and all that type of stuff. And then an infinite amount of different types of attestations just from this protocol.
Exactly. Yeah, and then they can reference each other. You can, if you wanted to, on the more technical end, if you wanted to give an attestation template to trigger some function in a smart contract and tie it into protocols or DAOs or
other
programmatic stuff, you can do that.
So like something based on a set of conditions, then X happens, and then that gets attested and signed and automatically. And that
exactly. Like one example I'm eager to explore is using this to facilitate user agreements with like the actual user agreement text document can be stored in a public database like Arweave. And then you can have a template for a user to agree to that user agreement. And then by agreeing to it, essentially sort of like an on-chain signature, a blockchain-based signature, that can trigger, you know, that they get access to some communication channel through some smart contract.
Or
they get added to an allow list somewhere that grants them access to something. All of that. But all of these mechanisms can be built and facilitated in ways that don't depend on any central institution to stay in business.
Yes.
Or don't really permit censorship, at least not in any straightforward fashion.
Yeah. And that's the key, because right now with things like central bank digital currencies being trying to be put on us, and, you know, all those the Google IDs and everything like that, we're entering an age where everything is going digital. All our bills, everything is being paid online. And at some point, some centralized entity could take our rights away from us, our digital property, our digital rights away from us, our ability to pay our bills. But if that is issued by a decentralized entity and our reputation and our ID is backed by a decentralized blockchain instead of some kind of centralized, you know, corporation or government, then that kind of helps to maintain a semblance of freedom and sovereignty in a digital space like this, right?
Totally. I mean, and to a much greater extent than relying on these privately run institutional you know, infrastructure stuff like
that,
this.
That's that are susceptible to politics and all type and wars and all types of stuff, you know? Yeah.
And even if the institutions are well-intentioned, maybe they just can't stay in business.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And like their servers are deprecated.
Yeah.
There's a lot more that can go wrong with the essentially run database for the purposes we're talking about.
Yeah. And the best we have right now is the Wayback Machine. And that's still like, you know, still centrally run.
Yeah, that's, and I think a good way to think about a lot of this is as digital public infrastructure or a new digital commons that actually isn't, like, because we kind of think of Twitter or X now as a sort of public square, but that's all centrally managed and centrally run. And they have private policies, and to some extent, they're subject to national jurisdictions and laws. Sure. But if that had some, you know, infrastructure like this, it would just have a totally different set of implications for what content moderation would look like, what content moderation would even be possible. So it does, a lot of this stuff has pretty interesting implications for how social media can work and online publishing and just our online lives, you know, in general.
Yeah. Well, man, that's amazing. I'm really happy that we've had the chance to actually sit down and like hammer this out, because I've been a little lost, to be honest, in some of the community calls when y'all were talking about it. And now I know exactly what y'all are talking about.
So, yeah, why we're so excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm super excited about it, you know? So, you know, people think that, you know, they're either on the, you know, doom and gloom side, or they're on like the technophile side of things with the advancement, but we don't have to be scared of technology and go be a Luddite. You know, we can move forward and try to maintain our decentralization and our sovereignty, you know, in the digital world. So I'm looking forward to more tools like this to help maintain that. So
exactly. Yeah. Like it's we're kind of building a new phase of the commons.
No, absolutely.
That's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot. Let's go back to the JournoDAO website. Oh, I don't have it pulled up anymore. If you want to pull it up, yeah, we can add it. And yeah, go check us out. Again, it's Wednesday at 9 Pacific time. How can people get in touch with you, Spencer?
I am discoverable as Clinomenic on Twitter or X, Lens, Farcaster. You can go to www.clinomenic.com and find contact info there, or email me at ssc@clinomenic.com, or find me in the JournoDAO server. So there's all those options. Happy to connect with people who are interested in this.
Yeah, we don't make ourselves hard to find. I'm Eureka John, the number one. Somebody else got Eureka John. I have no idea how, but yeah. It's an inactive account now, so don't go there. Go Eureka John 1, and then on Discord I'm Eureka John. On Telegram, guess what? I'm Eureka John. I'm on Farcaster too, and like some of these other Web3 tools. And email, you can email me at EurekaStreetCreative@gmail.com if you want. Sometimes email is even better. You know, like, there's so much noise. Yeah. Oh, that's another thing I wanted to mention too. The attestations, like, can help separate the noise from the signal, because it's impossible. There's so much noise going around, like between cat videos and porn and people taking pictures of their dinner and stuff like that. There's just so much crap going up online. What attestations can help do is to just separate the signal from all that noise and just only upload verification that something is real rather than the actual content.
Yeah, exactly. Because you are kind of, you know, staking your reputation on what it is you're attesting to, and you don't want to attest to, you know, frivolous or things that you don't want to, you know, stake your reputation on.
Yeah. So cool, man. Anyway, yeah, the future's looking bright after this. All right. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to doing more of these podcast episodes, these press fix episodes with you and the other members of the JournoDAO and any guests that we want to bring on. If you want to be a guest and talk about any aspects of Web3 journalism, feel free to reach out to us and contact us.
Please.
All right. And I'll play the outro music.